Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on our program today, travel restrictions will loosen for those with two shots, but not now.
What is currently being considered as the first step in this approach is to allow fully vaccinated individuals currently permitted to enter Canada to do so without the requirement to stay in government-authorized accommodations. As soon as we have a confirmed date, we'll come back, but the general ballpark is the first week in July.
So the first week in July, the government is considering easing off quarantine rules. Why not now? Why for NHL players an exception, but not for the rest of the country? The woman you just saw, the Minister of Public Health, Patty Hajdu, will join us in just a minute. Then, a community mourning and an investigation of the accused killer.
This is a deep scar, and it's going to take some time for that deep scar to heal.
In London, Ontario, a community ripped apart by a deadly act of hate attempts to move forward. But what are police learning about the motives behind the attack? We will get the latest from London, Ontario, from CTV's Morella Fernandez, then the CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, who spoke at the vigil last night, will be on the press gallery with his view on why federal politicians have failed in the past to take strong enough action against Islamophobia. Plus, a major new settlement for survivors of residential day schools.
Together, we will move forward on the path to reconciliation as we support the healing and commemoration of those affected by harmful policies of the past.
A 14-year fight comes to an end. The federal government announces a new settlement with the students of residential institutions who were attended those only by day. These students went home at night. $10,000 to survivors or their descendants. But what does it mean for other court cases? What prompted this settlement? We'll get the details from Cindy Blackstock, who is fighting to stop another lawsuit going on with the federal government. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. We begin tonight with the latest from the mass murder in London, Ontario. The murder of four members of a single family, a Muslim Canadian family. The serious injury to a fifth, a nine-year-old boy who's now orphaned, motivated by hate. Thousands of people were motivated because of that to gather at a mosque last night in London to show their support. Among the crowd, those who worked, prayed, and went to school with the Afzal family. They were remembered for their kindness, their generosity, and their faith. But what about the latest on the investigation? Let's go to CTV's Morella Fernandez. She's in London. Morella, we are learning more about what happened Sunday. Can you tell us? Tell us about how this all rolled out.
We are getting some more details today, Evan, from witness stories of what happened on Sunday. We know that the suspect was not arrested anywhere near the crime scene itself, but 7 kilometers away in an almost deserted parking lot at a mall here in London, Ontario, parking near a cab driver who was in his cab at the time. That cab driver telling his boss that the suspect got out of his vehicle, was wearing some sort of flak jacket, like a vest, almost like a bulletproof vest. We don't know if it was bulletproof, and a helmet, got out of his vehicle and told the cab driver to call 911. The cab driver did call 911 and also noticed that there was damage to the front of that pickup truck. But that was about 7 kilometers away from where the crash happened and where those four members of the family, five members actually hit, but four of them died, Evan. So we're beginning to piece together now some of the details.
Morella, so that's that part of the investigation. Let's focus on the family, the victims. Tell us about a little more about who they are and how much they were involved in that community.
Very involved in the community. We've heard from so many people today that especially the father, Salman Afzal, was at the mosque all the time, not just to worship, but to help, to volunteer, his wife as well, to do the same. And that they were very well respected, very well loved. I learned quite a bit today about the daughter, 15-year-old Yumna. Apparently, she was a top honor student. So this is the kind of kid that scores high 90s in all of her grades, never saw anything under a 95. She was in grade 9, started kindergarten grade 9 during a COVID year, of course, which was difficult for her. But she was not just a great student. She was also a very humble person and talented, apparently, in so many other things. An artist, as we know. We saw that mural that was painted in her elementary, in her grade school. I'm told that she took that on as a project, just sort of wanted to leave something behind in that school, took it on not really knowing how to use spray paint, but went for it. It's actually a massive mural. It's quite big, and it's quite detailed, and she did a great job. I'm told she wanted to make a mark in the world. She wanted to make a difference in the world. That was what she wanted to do, and she was very educated, very well-spoken, and likely would have been able to make a great mark in the world. What a loss at the age of 15.
Yeah, what a loss. And Mirella Fernandez there in London, Ontario. We're going to return to this story later in our program. Thank you, Mirella, as we saw footage there of some of the leaders, the mayor and some of the federal leaders there at the vigil last night. Again, we will return to this story. What needs to happen now in terms of action and what do federal leaders need to do? So we'll pick that up into the press gallery. But meantime, the wheels are slowly starting to lift for some grounded Canadian jet setters. Call it the two-shot travel plan unfolding today. Federal government says fully vaccinated Canadians will be able to travel outside of the country without this two-week quarantine that they have to do now, which means fully vaccinated Canadians would not need to stay in those quarantine hotels when they return to Canada. But when is this going to happen? Well, at this point, not until July. And it comes without any real updates on the status of vaccine passports or certification. So how does the plan actually work? Let's find out. Joining me now is the Federal Health Minister, Patty Hajdu. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, Minister. The federal government is aiming to have this whole notion of the, I call it the two-shot travel program, in place as early as July. No more stays in quarantine hotels or quarantining. But the Federal Advisory Committee says the quarantine hotels are basically useless. They should be stopped now. Why not just do this now? Why wait till July?
Well, first of all, Evan, we want to be absolutely sure that we are ready to commence this next stage of international travel. We've seen, the virus behave in ways that we wouldn't have been able to predict a year and a half ago. And the recovery that we've gained is precious. We've seen vaccination rates grow. We see communities recovering, and all of that is very important to Canadians. So we're going cautiously and slowly, of course, very thankful to the expert panel, and have used the information that they've gathered and presented to the Public Health Agency of Canada to design these next steps.
But if the federal government can make an exception for NHL players to go around the protocols for the playoffs, which has just happened, why can't the federal government make that exception for everyone else? Why the double standard?
Well, there have been exceptions for specific groups of travelers that have presented travel plans that include, for example, bubble quarantines and a variety of different proposals that are screened with provinces and with local public health to ensure that they have comfort in those plans. And this is not that. What we are talking about is the resumption of travel without the requirement to quarantine in a hotel and without the requirement of a 14-day quarantine for fully vaccinated travelers with right of entry to Canada. And that means that there aren't restrictions on movement. There isn't an expectation that they will behave in a certain way, that there is a confidence that that full vaccination allows for the alleviation of some of these measures.
But, you always say, and your government always says, that you listen to the science, but the Federal Advisory Panel on Travel says you don't need the quarantine hotels. You don't need to charge people $3,000. You can just actually give, they could have a quarantine hotel plan, a quarantine plan at home. So why at least not take the first step and dump those quarantine hotels?
This is a really important step towards the resumption of international travel in a way that does not jeopardize our recovery, Evan. And I will say that Dr. Tam and many others at the Public Health Agency of Canada have taken the advisory panel's recommendations and have provided a strong approach on how to safely begin the resumption of international travel in a way that doesn't put that recovery at jeopardy. I think about the communities that have struggled so much for a year and a half, the businesses that have lost income, the people that have been separated from loved ones. There is a lot of sacrifice that Canadians have made over the last year and a half, and we're seeing the finish line. We want to get there safely, and we want to get there in as smooth as possible way. The last thing I'll say, Evan, is internationally, countries are struggling with what to do with international travel. I look at my UK counterparts with a great deal of empathy as they try to resume travel and then have to make a U-turn and stop travel with specific countries. And I think what we're trying to do is have a strong plan that's cautious, that's safe, right, and that actually allows for us to continue on this path.
So, okay, and I appreciate that, but the ability to travel without a quarantine plan or without quarantining relies on Canadians' vaccination status. It's the two-shot plan. Your colleague, Minister LeBlanc, said earlier today the federal government is still working with the provinces on what proof of vaccination will look like. Manitoba, as you know, has rolled out this vaccine certification card. When will all this be finalized?
Well, there's two parts to that question, or two parts to the answer, I guess. And one is what you're talking about, which is outbound travel and creating a system of proof of vaccination in Canada so that people can present that to other countries if they need to at their ports of entry. That's a separate conversation and something that does require work with provinces and territories because they are the holders and keepers of that data, and that data has to be kept securely and privately. So that work is ongoing with colleagues. But what I'm talking about today is Canadians who have been vaccinated with one of the four approved vaccinations, maybe here in Canada, maybe in another country. And that proof of vaccination will require being uploaded in the CanArrive app. It can be uploaded in French and English. It can also be translated into French and English if the vaccination has happened in a country where those are not the primary languages. So we are working now with CBSA on the digital aspects of this and how best to make sure that we're ready to go when the program launches.
Okay, so that's a lot. So the program can't launch without that. So is the timeline, any specific timeline on when that system, any specific issues on privacy, how long that information will be kept, who gets to see that information, if there's a sunset clause on it, any details you can give us on how close you are to getting that system up and running?
Well, those are questions better suited for Minister Blair, who, as you know, has CBSA under his responsibilities and portfolio. But I will say that our agency is working really closely with CBSA to make sure that when we do launch, and our aim is early July, Evan, that all the tools are working well, that we've been able to test run the system, and that the system can recognize proof of vaccination in a variety of different formats.
But, Minister, a lot of Canadians have two shots already here, and I think there's over 3 million Canadians. When will the federal government have details of what fully vaccinated people can do? Like 3.3 million people are saying, I'd like to know.
We actually do have information, Evan, on what we can anticipate people will be able to do at various different vaccination rates of the country. It's available on the PHAC website, and I certainly hope that people check it out. But in terms of really specific details, like can I go to a crowded bar?
Yes.
Will I be able to go back to school? Those kinds of questions, those are really questions that are provincial and in some cases local in nature. Because, of course, we see disease activity in Manitoba that's so dramatically different than disease activity in PEI, for example. So there may be different local public health rules, but we have released some general guidance that Canadians can check out on the Public Health Agency of Canada website.
Okay, but obviously the CDC in the United States was way earlier on that. Let me just ask you a specific question. If a family is traveling and the adults have both shots, they're double vaxxed, but their children under 12 don't, will they have to isolate? What's the plan for them?
We're working on that now with provinces and territories, as well as within the agencies that are responsible for cross-border travel. Of course, we'll never separate traveling families. That's the first and foremost message I want families to hear today, is that families will not be asked to be separated in any way. And of course, we'll have more details on how that will be managed as we go forward. Not only families with children, but of course, we know there are other individuals that for health reasons cannot be vaccinated, and we'll have more details on how those cases will be managed.
By the way, and just, I know you'll have more details, but you know, we're in mid-June here, and there's almost 3.5 million Canadians with it. So by the end of June?
Oh, well, listen, that's my goal. My goal is as soon as possible. And so Dr. Tam is having those important conversations with her chief public health officer counterparts across the country. We want to make sure that everybody is comfortable with the science and with the approach, and you know, not put at risk again anybody's progress. This is really about slow and steady and cautious, so that whatever we do, we don't have to reverse in months if we see, you know, an increased disease activity. And And that's really the goal here, is to add, you know, take steps that are going to protect the gains that we've all made through a lot of sacrifice.
Just quickly, last question. Any news on when the U.S.-Canada border will reopen?
Listen, I spoke to Secretary Becerra, the health secretary from the United States, last week as part of our virtual G7 meetings. He and I agreed that we need to continue to work on a plan for Canada-U.S. that we're strong neighbors, friends, and trading partners, and that it has to be focused through the health lens. And so I think we've directed our officials to work together on what that might look like. I know the Prime Minister will be meeting with President Biden at his upcoming G7 meeting, so that work is ongoing.
Okay, interesting. We'll find out. Maybe there's something coming from the G7 this weekend. Health Minister Patty Hajdu, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Evan. Have a great day.
Okay, so we talked a bit about, you know, vaccine passports. Manitoba's got this vaccine certificate they rolled out earlier this week, but that's not all, because for a lot of people, as you know, getting the COVID-19 vaccine already feels like winning the lottery, especially that second shot. But for some lucky Manitobans, they might actually win a lottery by getting their vaccine shot. Get this. Manitoba is going to award nearly $2 million in cash and scholarship prizes in their newly announced vaccine lottery program. The province is hoping it's a cash incentive that will motivate Manitobans to get their shot, which is kind of weird because Canadians seem to be rushing to get a shot. All Manitobans 12 and up who get their first dose by August 2nd will automatically be eligible for the first draw, and those who get their second dose by September 6th will be eligible for the second draw. It's important to remember that Manitoba actually still leads Canada and the U.S. in per capita COVID-19 cases. So as demand for the vaccines remains high around the world, the Manitobans really need to be bribed to get their shot. So to talk about that and the new measures to ease restrictions at the border that we just spoke about with Patty Hajdu, let's get the man in charge of Manitoba. Joining me now is the Premier of Manitoba, Brian Pallister. Good to have you on the program, sir.
Hi, Evan.
I think the whole country's reeling right now. There's lots going on, but we'll get to that. I want to start with the federal government today announcing they're easing quarantine restrictions for fully vaccinating Canadians, but they're not doing it right away. Sometime in July, already an advisory panel have told them, get rid of these quarantine hotels. What's your reaction to this move?
Well, you know that yesterday we announced that we're going to take double vaxxers out of the realm of having to isolate for 2 weeks when they return to our province. And I'd like to see other provinces follow suit on that. So you get a sense of where we'd like to move here safely, reopening, getting back together again in this country, having a Canadian family reunion. So on the U.S. side, you know also, Evan, that we've taken initiatives to work with our neighbor in North Dakota on things like vaccinating truckers. And we know that we're linked economically, socially, in every way. We're very close allies. So the sooner we can extend these benefits to double vax people, I think, at the very least, the better. So applaud the announcement today and thank the federal government for it. And I think we need to look for more things that we can do to incite vaccinations to be pursued by Canadians as their first choice and a quick choice.
Okay, well, let's talk about that then. Before we get to the vaccination cards that you've got, you're trying to incite people with this lottery, $2 million. Why do you need that? The uptake in Canada has been really good. Why do you need a lottery and a scholarship program worth $2 million to motivate people to take a vaccine? What's the hesitation?
Well, you're going to get hesitation eventually, and somewhere, some parts of the country, in some regions, that's already there, and it's evident in other jurisdictions as well. We're trying to get ahead of the curve here and encourage people to make the choice and giving them a bit of a motivation to do that. For lots of our people and right across the country, you're motivated to get the vaccine for many other altruistic reasons. For some of our people, not so much. And with the presence now of variants that are nefarious and virulent and dangerous, then we need to get higher numbers. We need to get 85, 90% of our people vaccinated. This myth about 65 and 70% is just that. And so we have to push.
What's the myth?
Well, the myth that we can get out of this thing without maintaining a lot of restrictions with two-thirds of our people vaccinated is a myth. We're going to have in Manitoba, we'll have a third of our population still not vaccinated. We're at risk like everywhere else of going to a fourth wave. The sooner we can get our numbers up higher to 85, 90%, the better for everybody.
But I guess the question is,
the relationship's plain, right? The more people that are vaccinated, the more we get our lives back. Those two things go together.
But do you need $2 million to incentivize people is the question. You know, the leader of the NDP there, Wab Kanu, said, well, here's Brad Pallister finds $2 million for a lottery, and you've got intensive care units that have been overwhelmed. You've got to ship patients to Ontario. Why don't you fix your hospitals with $2 million instead of pulling out a lottery that maybe you don't need?
Well, it's just a dumb comment. What do you expect me to say?
Why is that a dumb comment?
Because, Evan, we spend more per capita on health, education, and social services in Manitoba than any other province already. So if the man thinks that $2 million more over to health care is going to solve the problem, he's wrong. This is a vaccine decision. It's a deeply personal decision. People have the right to control their decisions and their own body. We're trying to encourage them to make a decision we feel is the right one for them and for society generally. And this is a way to induce that. Right. This is a tiny fraction of what we invest in healthcare already.
I get that. But to be fair, your medical system was just overwhelmed. So I don't know why you would dismiss it as dumb when literally the entire medical system in Manitoba was literally just overwhelmed.
Well, because we've doubled our number of ICU beds since we came to government. We increased them significantly before the pandemic hit, doubled them since then. This isn't a question of a lack of investment in healthcare. This is a question of a lack of people getting vaccines. We need to have 90% of our people vaccinated. Investing more in healthcare, which is what we're doing every single day, isn't going to solve the vaccination problem. They're two different things. It's just an opposition politician making a comment because he feels he has to.
Well,
that's all.
To be fair, it may not just be a vaccine thing. It might be that your province opened up too early and then you got this wave. But let me ask you about this
cause. It might not be that too, though, Evan, to be fair, because we actually closed down sooner during the third wave than any other jurisdiction outside of the Atlantic bubble. So it isn't a question of that.
So what do you think happened? Like, I know you're not taking any responsibility, Premier, but
I am. I'm totally
responsible. Your province was the highest rate COVID per capita.
You can say that again, and that's why we're taking the measures we're taking, to work with community groups, to reach out, to try to encourage more people to get vaccinated. Let's face it, if everybody had been vaccinated 3 months ago, we wouldn't have had a third wave. Therefore, it makes sense to avoid a fourth wave by getting everybody vaccinated.
That's why we're focusing
on a vaccination encouragement strategy.
Look, I don't want to fight over people needing to be vaccinated, but you can't blame people for not getting vaccinated for the third wave. The government bears responsibility for protocols that it takes as well. You can't blame the folks for not getting vaccines that they didn't have. But talk about this.
So if you want to talk about vaccine supply issues, we can talk about those. The fact is we've built a team here, and every province has done it, so we can vaccinate as many people as possible with the vaccines we get, and we're doing that. Now we have extra capacity because, as in most jurisdictions around the world, you're seeing a certain lag start. We had hit a peak of participation about 5 weeks ago in the United States across the line with North Dakota, for example. They went from lineups in about 2 weeks to then having to encourage people. We're taking steps to encourage people now, because we want to see more people vaccinated. It's as simple as that.
Yesterday, you announced that the province was rolling out these immunization cards. And I spoke to the Winnipeg mayor, Brian Bowman. First of all, he said he didn't really know about it until yesterday. But he's raised concerns about how well thought out this is in terms of data privacy. Is there going to be a horizon, a sunset time in terms of how long these will be here? What access, who will keep this data? What are the privacy issues in terms of health data and who gets to see it? Can you give Manitobans assurance that their personal health information will be protected and how, if so, how?
Well, it's a card that demonstrates that you've been vaccinated twice. You get it only after 2 weeks after your second vaccine. That's it. That's the extent of it. It's a card that gives you the right to visit a senior in a senior's home who you love and haven't seen for months. It's a card that allows you not to have to isolate for 2 weeks after you return back to the province. Or, in fact, if you're deemed to be in close contact with a person who's come up with COVID, right? So it gives some limited benefits initially that are important benefits. People value the right to mobility that they've had taken away from them to a great degree, in particular here in Manitoba, where we maintain some of the toughest travel restrictions in the country throughout the pandemic, right? So these are important benefits that will accrue to those who choose to get two vaccines.
Two last things, if I can, Premier.
Sure.
Obviously, in the wake of what happened in London, Ontario, three generations of a family, four people killed. The police say it was motivated by Islamophobia. They were combated. What is your province doing to combat Islamophobia, and what should the federal government do?
Well, we've continued to take initiatives here within our public service, certainly, and as an example, I think, to the private sector, of better hiring practices, better anti-harassment strategies. No wrong door if someone is being harassed for whatever reason within our public service, Evan. These types of things we've initiated over the last 3 or 4 years are starting to, I think, bear fruit. There's much more that could be done. We certainly, on the Indigenous strategies, we've really worked to include and consult more on our number of policies and actions that we've taken, because I think it gets to actions, it gets to real economic equality, it gets to those things too. But as far as nationally is concerned, I know the federal government had recently on the Indigenous issue, you've covered so well, if I might say, in respect of Kamloops and other related issues. There's a heartrending series of issues, not new if you've read the Truth and Reconciliation Report of Justice Sinclair. These issues have to be pursued. This is a discussion that Canadians have to have with one another.
Will Manitoba pursue looking for unmarked graves at former residential institutions?
We already have, and we continue to, and we're ready to do more. We've been working on with the federal government, providing data and information to them. Clearly, as the TRC said, the federal government has to take the lead on this, but we're quite ready and have been ready and have been active participants in that specific section of the TRC, but in other sections, obviously, as well.
Last question. A lot of the federal leaders who came together over the Islamophobia, they called to action, but they've been criticized for almost being silent on what's called Bill 21, the law in Quebec that prevents teachers, police officers, and bus drivers from wearing any religious symbol, the secularism law. Many people believe it targets religious symbolism. And that family was targeted because of the clothes they were wearing. You are one of the few people that spoke out against that. Is it incumbent on federal leaders to speak up more powerfully about that particular law in Quebec? And what would you say about it now?
Yes, it's incumbent on all of us to speak out on that law. And Premier Legault, I like very much, but he knows my view on that bill. We also suffer as a consequence of with a minority government in proximity to another election. You have already commented on that, I think, on your program, and others on your panels have. But it's too important to ignore. And the reality of the messages that are being sent by that bill and by, frankly, silence on some other things that we could be pursuing is very real and being felt by too many Canadians and by all of us, frankly. All of us are in this together. You know, Canada's precious thing, and it works because of its diversity, not in spite of it. And we need to be establishing how we can celebrate one another and the differences that we share in a more human way.
I got to leave it there, Premier. Premier Palliser in Manitoba, always good to have you, sir. Thanks.
Thanks, Evan.
Coming up, a major settlement for survivors of residential day institutions will break down the new agreement. But the ongoing legal challenges in other cases remain. Stay right here with PowerPlay.
The settlement will provide individual compensation of $10,000 for each eligible survivor class member for the harm suffered while attending an Indian residential school. However, we know that in many cases, the harm extends far beyond what can be fixed by any dollar amount. We know that the impacts of residential schools have left scars, not only on survivors, but also their descendants.
Okay, so there's a lot going on here, and I want to put this into context. The federal government has reached a proposed settlement with a group of residential, I'll use the word here, school survivors, institution survivors. But these are day scholars, they're called. These are students who attended a residential institution during the day but returned home at night, including at the Kamloops institution where the remains of 215 children were found in unmarked graves. But these children, students, were not eligible for compensation as part of the 2006 Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. Eligible day school survivors are set to receive, as the minister just said, $10,000 in compensation, the same amount available for those who stayed the night at residential institutions. Now, this settlement comes on the heels of the horrific finding, as I just said, of the remains of those Indigenous children at the residential institution in Kamloops, BC. But there are other court actions going on, and the federal government is still fighting students who attended these. So I'm going to talk about that with Cindy Blackstock. She's the executive director of First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, and she's been at the forefront of leading the fight for the federal government to drop some of these settlements. So first of all, Cindy, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
This particular settlement into perspective, what's your reaction to it, and what does it tell you?
Well, you know, I'm grateful that the survivors of the day school are getting a small measure of justice, but I want to emphasize small. $10,000, really? That's what they think the harms that occurred to these people are worth? I realize that litigation is still ongoing, but that to me is, it just really is such a small amount. And that settlement is happening in the context of the government of Canada still fighting against the survivors of St. Anne's Residential School. And keep in mind, Evan, that's a school that had the electric chair. And Canada on Monday will be fighting First Nations children. And I emphasize children, the grandchildren often of residential school survivors in court to deny them compensation for Canada's contemporary discrimination against them that resulted in unnecessary family separations, harms and deaths, and also to try and limit the federal government's provision of Jordan's principle, which is help for kids off reserve.
Yeah, and so I'm talking to Cindy Blackstock. I want folks to understand, the, quote, day school survivors who got $10,000 today, that was a 14-year fight. They settled today, finally. But as you say, you don't think the amount they've settled with $10,000 each is enough. But there are ongoing litigation against kids that attended the St. Anne's School, as you just said, which had brutal, brutal practices. And then as you, I just want folks to understand, next week the federal government continues in court for kids who are taken into the child welfare system that a human rights tribunal said they deserve $40,000 each. So while this is settled today, what does it tell you that there's all this other litigation still going on, Cindy?
That the government is really not committed to the TRC's calls to action. In our case, with the children, the child welfare equity and also Jordan's principle are the top calls to action for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Canada is actively litigating against the implementation of those calls to action. So that's very problematic. What gives me some hope is the upswell of Canadian awareness and the pressure on government to actually implement these calls to action. But there's all kinds of hypocrisy happening between what the government says and what the government does for First Nations children, for Métis and Inuit children, and as well as for survivors.
I just want to remind our viewers, you heard Cindy Blackstock talk about Jordan's principle, which is meant to ensure that Indigenous children have access to services without jurisdictional delays, and they don't
right.
at this point. Cindy Blackstock, always a pleasure to have you. And so that's one case settled. Obviously, you're not happy about that, but we'll be watching this in the next week closely. Always good to have you back on the program, Cindy. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Evan. Bye-bye.
Okay, and by the way, I should say there's a crisis line available for survivors and for families 24 hours a day. The number is 1-866-925-4419. Coming up, the Ontario government already rose for the summer break, but get this, Premier Ford wants to recall the legislature to invoke what used to be the political nuclear button, the notwithstanding clause. What's going on? This is a big moment. CTV's Colin DeMello has all the details next. Stay right here with Power Play. Well, it used to be considered something of a political nuclear button, but recently provinces are quick to use the famed notwithstanding clause that was part of the 1982 Constitution. Remember, this is a clause that was inserted there that would allow a provincial government, supposedly in a very rare circumstance, to override a charter ruling and impose a law that may violate the charter. Again, it was supposed to be used very rarely. It was supposed to be a big deal, but lately, the currency's been devalued. It's being used more and more. Remember, the Quebec government has recently said they would use the controversial notwithstanding clause to defend their controversial secularization law, which would ban people like teachers and police officers and bus drivers from wearing any religious symbol. And now, too, in Ontario, after rising for their summer break last week, the Ford government is seeking to recall the Ontario legislature. And now they say today they will invoke the notwithstanding clause concerning pre-election spending. What is this about? CTV News Queen's Park Bureau Chief Colin DeMello is here. Well, I guess you have to scrub your calendar, Colin. What prompted the move to not only recall the legislature, but this is a big deal, and I don't want to gloss over it, to invoke the notwithstanding clause?
Yeah, you know, you have to go back to 2016, Evan, to really get to the root of all of this. The former Liberal government had brought in legislation that would place limits on pre-election spending. So basically, the 6 months before the writ period in Ontario, that six-month period, third-party advertisers are limited to spending $600,000 for advertising. The Ford government wanted to double that. So it's basically a 12-month period now that third-party advertisers can only spend a max of $600,000 in pre-election advertising. So a couple of groups, including teachers' unions, took the government to court. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association was an intervener in this case. And the judge yesterday had ruled, yeah, this is unconstitutional. You can't just arbitrarily, infringe on people's right to free speech, 12 months before an election period. And so it was struck down yesterday. The government said that they were going to take some time to think about it. And today they came back and said, yeah, you know what? We're going to reintroduce the bill. We're going to invoke the notwithstanding clause. And the government says they're going to pass this as quickly as possible, perhaps by the middle of next week.
Okay, this is remarkable. So a judge says, no, you cannot limit free speech by essentially blocking out third parties from doing election advertising a year before. And the Ford government says, all right, too bad. We're going to use the notwithstanding clause to essentially overrule the court, which ruled based on charter free speech issues. What is the opposition saying about this?
Oh, well, the opposition is saying that the premier is basically trying to tip the scales in his favor before an election, that the progressive conservatives are trying to muzzle, any critics of the government, because, they're saying it's not just about education unions. It's about families who have children with autism. It's about those who aren't satisfied with the premier's pandemic response. They're saying this is throwing a chill over everyone who would want to negatively comment on the premier's performance. And so they're saying this isn't just about free speech. This is about election interference. And that's a pretty serious charge in and of itself.
Yeah, this is going to be another hot topic. Okay, CTV's Colin DeMello, I really appreciate you giving the update on that. That's a big issue coming out of Ontario. Thanks, Cole.
My pleasure.
Coming up, federal leaders provided solemn words at last night's vigil to the victims of the London mass murder. But going forward, what concrete policies will the government pursue to tackle Islamophobia? The CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, Mustafa Farouk, joins us next. Stay with us. Welcome back. Look, federal party leaders, all leaders, have been quick to condemn Islamophobia at last night's vigil, remembering the Afzal family, who were murdered, and the Prime Minister and all the leaders called it an act of terror. Today, the Intergovernmental Affairs Minister, Dominic LeBlanc, shared the federal government is working on ways to target hate on social media with specific measures to be shared in the coming weeks. They have said this for years, since the attack on the mosque in Quebec. But our special guest now has words about why the federal leaders have been so silent on other things. For example, what about Quebec's secularization bill 21 that prevents public workers from wearing religious clothing on the job? And what does it say that most conservatives opposed a motion in 2017 that condemned Islamophobia, including Aaron O'Toole? So are the new words of unity and action hollow words? What needs to happen? The press gallery is here. Robert Benzie is the Toronto Star's Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Andy Bergeron-Oliver, parliamentary reporter at CTV National News, And Mustafa Farouk is the CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims. He spoke last night at the vigil. By the way, welcome to everyone. Mustafa Farouk, your words were very powerful. I thought it was an incredibly moving and powerful vigil last night. So our thoughts are with the community as the impact of this continues. I recognize how important support from leaders are, but when it comes to things like the Bill 21 in Quebec, which I know is very popular there, federal leaders have been basically quiet. Should they, in your mind, be speaking up about things like that?
Well, I mean, let's situate what happened last night within a broader context. I think it's impossible to fully understand the scale of what happened at the London Muslim Mosque without situating it in a broader context. In 2017, we had the Quebec City Mosque Massacre. In 2020, we had the attack at the IMO where a man was killed. In London, we've had people literally run down, an entire family exterminated with one child remaining, and yet still just a few hours drive away from there. If you're Muslim and you wear a hijab, you can't become a prosecutor. You can't become a police officer. That's unacceptable. It's truly, like, it's hard to fully even grapple the fact that here in Canada, that in any part of this nation, that that is the law. It's not okay. All the federal leaders need to do more. While, you know, many of them have spoken up to emphasize their opposition to Bill 21, they have not done nearly enough. And that's every single federal leader to stop this piece of discriminatory legislation in Canada.
Annie, I know the Prime Minister has said he doesn't like it, but there have been no constitutional challenge on it. What do you make about that and how this is breaking down politically, whether it's on Bill 21 or the 2017, the quote, Motion 103 on Islamophobia?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to...
Well, as you just heard, I think there's... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Annie Bergeron-Oliver.
Sure. So as you just heard, there is increasing pressure on the Prime Minister to come out much stronger in condemning Bill 21. You know, I've heard some people say they now question the Prime Minister's sincerity, that they appreciate the words of thanks and the prayers that he's offering to the Muslim community and others who have been so tragically hurt by the incidents in London. But some people are telling me that, you know, it's not enough for the Prime Minister to condemn Islamophobia and say he wants to hate it, while also just saying he's going to sit back and watch what happens to the challenge in Quebec instead of using his position of authority to step in, to condemn it, to say that's not okay, and to make those comments much stronger. The problem for the Prime Minister, as Legault reminded Trudeau yesterday, a majority of Quebecers are still in favor of this bill, and the Prime Minister, with a potential election in September of October, you know, still right. needs Quebec in order to form a majority government. But I do think that recent events and the increasing number of hate crimes and other such things over the pandemic really has put an increased pressure on the Prime Minister to perhaps strengthen his position and take a much stronger stance.
Robert Benzie.
Well, exactly. What Annie and Mustafa are saying is bang on. And here in Ontario, Bill 21 is very, very unpopular. It is seen, rightly, as an Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, and racist law. And at the Ontario legislature, MPPs from all parties voted unanimously to condemn that bill when it came to the floor of Quebec's National Assembly. And that's very rare that you see one provincial legislature condemning another provincial legislature's law. And in fact, you see a lot of Ontario hospitals and others saying, welcoming in nurses and doctors who keep the hijab, because they say, look, we want you here if you wear a turban or if you wear a hijab. Or other religious attire, you are welcomed in Ontario, and it's been seen and it's going to contribute to a brain drain in Quebec, I think, if it hasn't already.
Yeah, Mustafa, the National Council of Canadian Muslims is one of the groups fighting to overturn that. It's not happening. What concrete actions? I mean, again, the words are important of support, but they're hollow if they don't follow up with action. What's the kind of hard action you need to see right now?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's important to note that Bill 21, in part, was struck down with our court challenge and the court challenge of other groups like the EMSB. So, for example, now English school board teachers are no longer covered under Bill 21, which is a positive step. But that's why the Quebec government and we are both cross-appealing the judgment. The Prime Minister has talked about, you know, waiting and watching for what the groups who are challenging, the Quebec groups like ours, based out of Quebec, what they're doing to stand up against Bill 21. We need to see him immediately today say that he's going to get involved in our court challenge and stand against Bill 21 in court when it goes to the Quebec Court of Appeal, when it goes to the Supreme Court of Canada. But he needs to do much more than that. This is a systemic problem. This is a systemic issue. That's why we need to see a national action summit on ending Islamophobia.
Yeah, I, you know, you're a lawyer outside of the summit, but quickly, Annie and Benz, you saw Ontario saying they're going to use the notwithstanding clause on an election spending issue. But Quebec, Annie has said they'll use the notwithstanding clause to defend Bill 21 if it's seen as unconstitutional. It's like the notwithstanding clause, you know, it's being used for all sorts of things, and it may but well be used in this case, too.
Yeah, and this comes all at a very bad time for the... Go ahead, Benzie.
Go for it. Sorry, the audience.
Yeah, everyone's having a hard time. Real quick to Annie and then Benz. Annie.
I was just going to say, all of this comes for a bad time for the Prime Minister. You know, he is potentially going to be going into an election in September. He needs the support. He's walking a fine line here, and it seems like he needs to come out with a stronger stance, but it's going to hurt somebody in terms of votes. You know, either Quebec is angry at him if he comes out much stronger, or there's a large number of people who will be mad at him for not condemning Bill 21. So he does need to come out stronger on that, and the notwithstanding clause in Quebec on Bill 21. Whenever that happens, this could, you know, also inflame tensions heading into an election.
Benz, I know you're going to bone up on this notwithstanding real quick. Go ahead.
Well, Doug Ford is invoking Section 33 for the first time in Ontario history because he's unhappy about a judicial ruling that helped unions in their electoral advertising that attacking the government. And he's not very happy about that ruling that happened yesterday. So today he said that tomorrow they will invoke the notwithstanding clause and recall the legislature. That's never happened in Ontario before. Quebec's used it a dozen times, though.
Yeah, well, the notwithstanding clause is going to be a very big issue when you're talking about rights and constitutional rights. All right, Rob, Annie, Mustafa, great to have all three of you on. I really appreciate it. That is your Power Play Day in politics. Thanks so much for all of you for watching. We're back here in 23 short hours. If it's safe and we need to, hug your loved ones and cherish them. Have a great evening. We'll be right back.